And now I want to introduce another amazing woman. And I have to say, around the world, there's no doubt that women are leading the way. They are two brain halves are more connected, and somehow it's easier for us to see the connections, and above all, to see the human connection to the earth. And so all around the world, you'll see that the real worker bees are women. And I just wish there were more of us on the stages. And Judy is one of those women who's been brave enough to stand up and speak out. You probably, most of you know, that she is essentially the founder, took the initiative to BALEE, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, that she's been running this amazing White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia for many years and was a pioneer of localization. And now her book, Good Morning, Beautiful Business, which is available here, and she'll be signing books tomorrow at 11. So I hope you're all going to read her story and support her work. I want to thank Judy for also being willing to participate in our Economics of Happiness conferences around the country. And she's been, she's been an amazing support and an amazing inspiration to me. Thank you, Judy. Oh, yeah, here's the mic.
Oh, Mike, that'll help. Well, thank you, Helena. And thank you to Karen and all the local folks that did all the work to put this conference on. And thanks to this great community, very welcoming community, learning a lot from so many people. When I ran the White Dog Cafe, I did sell it 7 years ago. I'm retired from the restaurant business finally, thank goodness. But during the many years that I ran the White Dog, 26 years, I had a sign in my closet door that I would see each morning when I got dressed that said, "Good morning, beautiful business." And it was a reminder to me of just how beautiful business is when we put our creativity and our energy and our time into producing a product or a service that we then offer to our community. So it would be a time in the morning when I would take a moment to think about my own business and how the farmers are out in the fields picking organic fruits and vegetables to bring into town that day. And I'd think of the farm animals out in fresh air and pasture. And of our goat herder, Dougie, who said that when she kissed her goat's ears, it made the cheese better. I think that's true. For me, business is about relationships. Relationships with those that we buy from and sell to and work with, and about our relationship with nature itself. Money is simply a tool. Business is about relationships. And my business was really the way that I expressed my love of life. And that's what made it a thing of beauty. So I grew up in a small town in western Pennsylvania called Ingomar. This was the busiest intersection because that's where the beer distributor was. But as a child, I saw the important role that small business owners played in our community life. The butcher, the baker, the ice cream maker, right across from here was the local pharmacy, and on the other corner was the hardware store where the men used to gather for coffee in the morning, and the butcher shop where my grandmother would go, and the butcher would say, "Well, how was that turkey last Thanksgiving, or how was that steak Saturday night," or whatever. So one of the most important experiences I had was living in, with Indigenous people. I spent a year in Alaska as a VISTA volunteer when I was 22 years old. It's funny, I have a little bit of similarity in our background with Helena in terms of having the experience of being with Indigenous people. I was sitting on my roof, and that was in the spring after the snow had melted. During the winter, it was above my roof. I have to dig out. From the Indigenous people, I had the opportunity to actually witness a culture that was based on sharing and cooperation. As an example, in the spring, I heard a knock on my door and I opened it, and there was an Eskimo woman beckoning to me and saying, "Seal party, seal party." And I went to find out that the tradition is that after a man catches his first seal after a long, hard winter in the spring, his wife has a seal party and invites all the women over to her house, and they then divide the meat of the seal between all the families. And you can see these buckets of blubber and meat, and then anything that the family has accumulated during the year that they don't need to survive, they also give away, and the women are putting gifts in their skirts And then at the end, the grand finale is that bubble gum and hard candy is thrown into the air. And that was my favorite part. So, you know, the Eskimos had no sense of envy. If you admired something an Eskimo had, they would give it to you. So you have to watch out what you admire. And, you know, there was no idea about hoarding more than you needed. And it made me think back about my own culture and how we actually admire the people the most who have the most, who hoard the most, who have the biggest houses or the biggest cars or the biggest wardrobes. And we're never satisfied because advertising keeps us buying more and more. Yet the Eskimos were the happiest people I'd ever met. And I came to realize that it was because their happiness and security did not depend on money and material goods. Their happiness and security depended on community. So this is my home and my first business, or no, actually not my first business, but a business I started in 1983, the White Dog Cafe. It started as a muffin shop and grew to be a $5 million restaurant by expanding to the houses next to it and an addition off the back. And I think the reason I was so successful is because I grew deeper in my place. I was a very community-based business, and I'll explain more about that as we go along. And I do feel that taking responsibility for a place is the first step in building a sustainable economy or living economy, as some of us like to call it. And this was the watercolor of the block where I lived for over 40 years. So living upstairs, I raised my kids above the shop, the old-fashioned way of doing business. And I think that really gave me a different business outlook, you know, living and working in the same community. Because we're more likely to have the same values at home as at work. Oftentimes we're separated from our values when we travel between to a different community to work in. So at home we teach our children the golden rule, but at work, gold rules. So by living and working in the same community, I think I had a greater balance of head and heart. And I'll give you some examples of that. This is Greg, a dishwasher at the White Dog. This picture was actually taken in Cuba where we had a sister restaurant relationship. But I have this picture up because I first heard about paying a living wage and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't pay dishwashers a living wage. I'd go broke. You know, I just dismissed it. But then I was in the kitchen one day and Greg and two other dishwashers happened to look up at me while they were peeling potatoes or carrots or whatever. And the light bulb went off in my head and I thought, what am I saying? Of course I want anyone that works full time at the White Dog Cafe to be able to pay their rent and buy their food and clothing and so on. Of course I want to pay a living wage. But that came because of the personal connection that I had with the people who worked for me. Another example is my relationship with nature. I had heard about climate change. I knew that in Pennsylvania we were deregulated like California was so that we could buy from a third party supplier and buy renewable energy. But I hadn't been motivated to act until there was a drought in Pennsylvania. And I was walking in the woods that I love to walk in and saw how the drought was affecting the woods and how the creek was all dried up, just dust on the rocks. And as I walked along, it was just the creaking of all the sticks and the leaves were starting to fall from the trees, even though it was August. It was just an eerie silence. Not even the birds were singing. And I realized, oh my gosh, this is what it's going to be like because of climate change. This was in the year 2000. That parts of the land are going to have droughts and fires because there was just a sense of fire in the air. It was I could just feel it in my heart. And other parts of the land will have storms and floods. So I just went over and hugged a big oak tree. I became a tree hugger and pressed my face against the bark and promised that I would go back to Philadelphia and find out about signing up for renewable energy. And the White Dog became the first business in the state of Pennsylvania to buy 100% of our electricity from renewable sources. So one of the things I can't stand about the business world is this grow or die mantra. Meanwhile, when there's a short distance between business people and those affected by their decisions, like employees, customers, and so on, we're more likely to make decisions from the heart. But most CEOs, as companies grow, get further and further and further away from those affected by their decisions. And people used to say to me, well, how many restaurants do you have? And I'd say, well, just one, you know. And this felt like a failure on my part. But then I realized that I didn't want to grow any bigger than one restaurant because I wanted to maintain those authentic relationships with everybody that I worked with and sold to. So rather than starting another White Dog in someone else's community, I started a Black Cat in my own community next door to the White Dog Cafe where we sold locally made products, a retail store. So I began to see that chains were like invasive species. You know, they go into other people's communities and smother out the indigenous businesses. And so that got me thinking, okay, well, how does a business grow in a healthy way? Well, businesses, like nature, can grow deeper in place. That's how nature grows. Nature grows deeper. Unlike chains that simplify everything, nature becomes more complex as it grows deeper in place. More resilient, more creative, more diverse, more adaptive to the needs of the ecosystem. And that's just how we can grow our businesses. And we don't have to just be mom and pops. In nature, there's a thing called the mother tree, a tree that's much larger than all the rest, and that under the ground, the mother tree nurtures the other plants and trees around it. A great example of this way to grow is Zingerman's Deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which a very popular deli. They could have had a chain across the country, but instead of doing that, they looked to see what their community needed. They started a bakery. They started a creamery to make their own ice cream and cheese and so on. They started a candy company. They started a small farm to grow vegetables for their restaurants. They started a full-service restaurant, et cetera. And so they had a whole family of businesses, and not only that, but they were able to give ownership opportunities to their employees in each of these new restaurants. Another example closer to home for me is Devin Walls, an entrepreneur artist from a small town called Chester outside of Philadelphia. Devin was hired by a big corporation to go around and do pop-up stores and art exhibits in different towns, and which he did happily for a number of years. And then he realized that what he was doing was paving the way for chain stores to go in there, that they were developing the market. So he decided to come home to Chester and put everything he had into his own town, which is a 98% African-American, low-income a town where the main street had a lot of boarded up stores. And so I'm part of an impact fund that was started by Ben Cohen. And we are now working with Devin as partners to buy real estate up on Main Street. And Devin has now started a restaurant, an art gallery. He has a theater, a nonprofit. And so he's growing deeper in place and providing the needs of his community. So we also don't have to grow materially. We can grow by expanding our consciousness, by increasing our knowledge, by deepening our relationships, by developing our creativity, building community, and having more fun. So I'll show you the ways in which the White Dog Cafe did this. We would have table talks after dinner, this is on Cuba, on issues of public concern to expand our consciousness, to grow our knowledge, to build community. Here's Patch Adams at a breakfast talk talking about how humor is so good for healing and necessary for our healing. We did storytelling with underrepresented voices, tales from jails, or in this case, a gay couple and a lesbian couple telling their story about same-sex marriage. We did community tours. This is an affordable housing tour. We'd go to farms, we'd go to prisons, we'd go to solar houses. We also did community events, Martin Luther King dinner. This was the first annual event that I started, and we did it every year until I sold the restaurant 26 years later. A Freedom Seder. A Native American Thanksgiving dinner where we gave thanks to Native Americans for all the foods in our contemporary diet that were first cultivated by Native people. And we'd have a Native speaker on the issues of the day for Native people, as well as inviting the Lenape Indians from our region, the first people of our region, to come and join us for our dinner. And we had a lot of fun. We'd close off the street. This was on the eve of 4th of July, the Liberty and Justice for All Ball, and would serve maybe 200 people a farm fresh buffet dinner. And then after dinner, I did this little skit called Birth of a Nation. Well, first the Revolutionary War guy would come out with his drum. Then I would come out, a pregnant colonial woman, with my midwife. And on my back, I had a sign that said, George Washington slept here. So my midwife helped me into bed, and she said, 1, 2, 3, and the audience all yelled, push! And under the covers, I pushed my beach ball down through a hidden hole in the bottom of the bed, and then she birthed my twins. Here comes the first one, called Liberty. The next one is called Justice. And they hopped on the stage and did a tap dance, a Yankee Doodle Dandy. Then we wheeled out the Statue of Liberty and lit our candles and sparklers and sang God Bless America. And that was just so much fun. And a lot of times we think about how we have to use a lot of dollars and carbons to go to faraway places, go to Hawaii or Fiji or someplace to have fun. Well, we can have more fun in our own community because we can use that opportunity to connect and build relationships. So here's Mark Dornstrike and Judy Dornstrike from Branch Creek Farm, and they were one of the key farmers that we bought our vegetables from, organic vegetables, for the White Dog. And Mark once said to me that good farming is the appropriate balance of feminine and masculine energy, which he defined as masculine energy being about efficiency and feminine about nurturing. If you have too much efficiency and not enough nurturing, you might have a well-run farm, but you're not going to have good tomatoes. On the other hand, if you have too much nurturing and not enough efficiency, you might have healthy chickens and great tomatoes, but you're going to go out of business because you're not using your time in an efficient way. So the most horrific example of this is the factory farming of animals, these battery cages where these mother hens are kept. So the whole name of the game here is efficiency. How can we give the hen the least amount of space, the least amount of air and light, the least amount of water and food to get the cheapest egg possible? No nurturing in this situation. It's just an abundance of masculine energy. And I'm not talking about gender here, but rather the balance of these energies in each of us, male and female both. So at the White Dog, we only bought chickens that were raised on pasture, and same with the eggs. Then I found out about the factory farming of pigs, and this just really, really got me, because pigs are mammals, like our dogs, like us, like human beings. We all share the capacity to have basic emotions, you know, of joy and grief and fear and so on. We see all these expressions on the faces of our dogs, the joy of going for a walk, the guilt of stealing a piece of sausage off the coffee table. So these are sentient beings who are highly intelligent, kept in these cages where they can't take a step forward or backwards or turn around their entire lives, artificially inseminated, the baby's taken away again, artificially inseminated again, as though they're a piece of machinery in a factory. So I was horrified when I heard about this, and I just went into the kitchen in a daze because I realized that the pork I was buying at the White Dog must come from the system, because if you don't know otherwise, that's where it comes from in this country and increasingly around the world. So I just came to the kitchen and said, we have to take pork off the menu, the bacon, the ham, the pork chops, until we can find a humane source for pork. And we did, and this is a picture of, thank you. I have to talk fast because I have a lot to say. Anyway, here's how pigs should be. This is one of the farms we buy from in Lancaster County. And they like to sleep in pig piles, touching each other. You know, they're very social creatures. Here's Bill Elkins. I found out about the plight of the cow, how cows are herbivores. They're supposed to eat grass, and instead they're put in barns and fed grain. So Bill has a herd of black Angus. He used to finish them on grain, and I said, would you provide some 100% grass-fed for the White Dog? And he did. It was the first time he tried it, and it turned out great. And Patty LaBelle used to pull up in her chauffeur to the White Dog, and her chauffeur would run in her limousine, her chauffeur would run in and get a Buck Run burger because she wanted to have 100% grass-fed. So I finally got to the point. This is Dougie, the one that kisses her goat's ears. Look at those sweet ears. Wouldn't you want to kiss them too? Anyway, I finally got to the point where I looked at my menu and thought, well, we've finally done it. All of our animal products come from small family farms where the animals are treated with respect and kindness. This is going to be our market niche. This is our competitive advantage. This is all about us. But then I realized that if I really did care about those pigs, if I cared about the small farmers that were being driven out of business, if I cared about the environment that was being polluted by this concentration of manure, and I cared about the consumers who were eating meat that was full of hormones and antibiotics, then rather than keeping this as my proprietary information, my list of suppliers of farmers that we had developed over a 20-year period, well, I guess at that point it was more like 15 years, but nevertheless, that I would share this information with my competitors. Because I realized that there is no such thing as one sustainable business. We can only be part of a sustainable system, that we have to look at this whole system in which we live. I had been seeing my little network of farmers around the White Dog is great. I was really proud of myself. You know, I'm buying from local farmers. Aren't they great? But that's not enough, that little network. We're within a system that's much bigger, our regional food system. And so I needed to turn my attention to the regional food system because in the long term, I needed my farmers to be successful in order for me to be successful. We need to build a system in a cooperative way that benefits everyone. So I turned to Glenn. This was at the Dance of the Ripe Tomato. And Glenn Brendel had been bringing the White Dog Cafe 2 pigs a week. We would use 2 whole pigs, we'd use all the parts of the animal because it's more respectful to the animal and much better for the farmer. And so I said to Glenn, would you like to expand your business? And he said, yes. And I said, well, what's holding you back? And he said he needed $30,000 to buy a refrigerated truck so that he could deliver to many restaurants when he came into town. So I loaned him $30,000 and he bought the truck and he's paid it back many years ago. And then I started a nonprofit called Fair Food, and that little list of the White Dog's farmers eventually turned into a local food guide for our region with many, many restaurants that buy from local farmers and the CSAs and the farmer stands and so on. So now another big lesson for me was from the Zapatistas, and it seems to me through my life I keep learning from indigenous people, but I wanted to know why did they have their uprising on January 1st, 1994 when NAFTA went into effect, and so I went down there to find out and learned about something I had never thought of before, and that's the concept of self-reliance, of local self-reliance, of community self-reliance. And that was what they were fighting for, that they didn't want to be sucked into the global economy. They wanted to be able to grow their own corn and not be forced out of business through NAFTA that would allow cheap subsidized corn, subsidized from our tax money through the Farm Bill, to corporate farm growers in the United States to dump cheap corn into Mexico and put these indigenous people out of business. And, of course, that did happen and caused a huge wave of illegal immigration. So anyway, the Zapatistas were fighting to preserve their self-reliance. They were fighting to be able to teach their children in their own languages and their own culture and ethics, to maintain their culture and not be sucked into the global monoculture of Western lifestyle, to be able to wear the same clothes that their women weaved for them. And not be forced off the farms and into the cities and into working in maquiladoras to provide clothing for the United States and Europe at a cheap cost. So I thought I had gone down to Chiapas to help the Zapatistas, but in the end, I was helped more than I helped them in that I realized the similarities between my farmers at home and the farmers in Chiapas, that our farmers were being driven off the land also by corporate power and subsidies that were making it unaffordable to be a farmer any longer. So I realized that the call of the Zapatista was really the call for all of us around the world, that we're losing our self-reliance, that we're losing our food security, our energy security, and so on, that we need to produce our basic needs at home. And so I began to envision a global network of local living economies that were connected by fair trade routes that we, this isn't a very good, I need a better picture of this because that looks so corporate, you know. but the idea is that this is really a global movement, that we're still a global economy, that we produce our basic needs at home, food, energy, water, and clothing as much as we can. As much as we produce at home. But then we connect globally to share with others, to share our culture, our favorite wine, our favorite cheese, a special fashion that is unique to our community because we're supporting our entrepreneurs to get into business. So from there, I co-founded the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, and David Corton, who's here somewhere, I think, was a founding board member of BALI. And so, thank you. So, but basically, some of the basic principles of our movement for local living economies is most importantly to support local business ownership, that we want to pull that economic power back to our communities and have broad-based ownership. And also to both in retail and in local manufacturing, and to develop local supply chains, farm to table, not only the fresh food, but how can we support local entrepreneurs to make products from those local fruits and vegetables that can last us throughout the winter. So that when we go in the grocery store, it's not just the fresh section that's local, but the middle aisles. How can we make those middle aisles also local? Dirt to shirt. Here's my friend Eric Henry in the green jacket. He has a company that prints logos on T-shirts, and he noticed that he started getting T-shirts that were made in China, and he thought, what's this? North Carolina is a cotton state. So he recreated the supply chain from the cotton farmer to the ginner to the the weaver or whatever, to the cutter, you know, all the different steps in the supply chain. And these are all the business owners, no women there, unfortunately. But anyway, those are the guys that he put together to start making cotton of the Carolinas, 100% Carolina Cotton in his t-shirts, and now they've also been experimenting with different kind of dyes. They use tobacco for brown, for dyeing fabric brown, and all kinds of local healthy dyes, because that's another thing that's really bad about our fashion industry. Forested furniture, making our homes out of sustainably grown wood that's grown locally. Our toys, our utensils, our furniture. Sun to socket, of course, with solar installation on our roofs and EV charging station for our cars. Botanicals to body, growing our own medicinal herbs, learning how to use them so we're not reliant on pharmaceutical companies, and also creating products like shampoos and soaps and lotions and whatnot. And basically, also a very important part of Bali's work is that we want to have an inclusive economy with prosperity for all. So one of the foundational programs is a fellowship program, and over half of those fellows, which are leaders in communities across the United States and Canada, are people of color. Another important part is receiving a living return, that when we invest in our local communities, we get a living return, also a financial return in many cases, or maybe a substantial one. But the more important thing, I think, is receiving a living return, which is living in a community that's healthier, that's happier because of our investments. And I have a local project called the Circle of Aunts and Uncles, where we gathered 35 people that each put money into a pot, and we have a local microloan fund. We make loans of up to $12,000 for local entrepreneurs who don't have a family members to give that early stage family money. And also, we provide social capital. Here was our last meeting just 2 weeks ago with a young man pitching his store that we... Well, loaned him $5,000 for printing, so he prints his designs on T-shirts. Here's a Latino sister and brother. They have a fashion industry, and I'm choosing the jacket I'm planning to buy from them. So in the long run, I feel that local self-reliance in food, water, and energy builds the foundation for world peace, because these are the things that we usually fight about. If every community had security in these issues, I feel like that will lead towards world peace. And of course, climate change is the biggest threat right now to all of us, and that's been discussed earlier. And I feel that local economies, self-reliant local economies, first of all, reduce the carbons of long-distance shipping. So we're addressing the problem right now, but we're also preparing our communities for the effects of climate change that are coming this way, no matter what we do, to become more self-reliant in these basic needs. I feel like it's sort of like a fort preparing to be stormed, and all the villagers are coming to the fort and stacking up, bags and bringing in food and so on to fortify themselves. There's a sense of urgency that I feel about preparing our communities for what's to come, and really for our children and grandchildren. So in order to do this, we have to change the measure of success in business from profits to the health and well-being of our communities and ecosystems, from maximizing profits to maximizing relationships, because that's what business is really about. And doing this is really, there's a collective joy in working together towards a shared vision for our community. They say that the collective joy is lacking in our modern society, and I think we can find that again when we come together as a community and work towards a shared vision. So this is really all about moving from me to we, from individualism to community self-reliance, from competition to cooperation, from hoarding to sharing, from fear to love. And this might seem like a big ask, but it already exists in different cultures. And one of them, I had the opportunity to go to Standing Rock last November. And there I saw a culture like I saw when living with the Eskimos that was based on cooperation and sharing and community self-reliance and love. Really, there I saw this incredible, it was like an epic It was being witness to an epic struggle between two contrasting cultures and worldviews. On the left, the military protecting a worldview that's based on domination and separation and a them and an us. And in order to survive, you have to do whatever is necessary, violence or whatever, in order to win, because there's a scarcity and you've got to get yours. And it's a fear-based culture. And then that's contrasted to an indigenous worldview, which is shared by many non-natives that I saw at Standing Rock. And I really saw this in action, how there was a community in the camps at Standing Rock that was really a demonstration of these values of cooperation, of sharing, of coming from a place of love, that even after the water protectors would be attacked and some hurt by the opposing forces that were protecting the fossil fuel industry, they showed forgiveness and had forgiveness parades, you know, to the processions to the sheriff's office, and actually brought them gifts and supplies and so on. So it was just a remarkable contrast, and it really made me think about how indigenous people are really, when it boils down to it, asking us to do two things: respect your mother and protect your children. I mean, what could be more simple? Protect our mother, Mother Earth, our common mother, and protect our children for the future, and make our decisions in our life around those two things. So ultimately, we all belong to the vibrant community of life on Earth. And when we feel that interconnection, we can feel the suffering pigs. We can feel those that are devastated by wildfires and floods. And ultimately, we need, if we're going to move from a life-destroying economy to a life-supporting economy, we need to awaken the hearts of the entrepreneurs, as well as the investors and the consumers, to really lead with love. When I first thought about sharing my proprietary information with my competitors, I was afraid. I was afraid that my sales would go down, my profits would go down. And I didn't figure out in my head, hey, this is the right thing to do. I figured it out in my heart, because I love the pigs. And it was that love of the animals, of nature, of the small farmers that overcame my fear. So hopefully we will, as a civilization, be able to leave a viable planet for our children and the children of all species. And if we do so, it's going to be because humankind has evolved to the place where we can take our proper place in the web of life, not as exploiters, but as lovers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.